Well, good morning, everyone. As advertised, my name is Brian Train, and today I'm going to talk for a few minutes about news games, which are a relatively new term that was originally used for a type of journalism committed by video game. This term was originally invented by the designer and academic researcher Gonzalo Frasca in 2003 in connection with his satirical video game September 12th. It started to become widely used in the game studies academic community when News Games Journalism at Play was published in 2011. Now, in the book, Ian Bogost, one of the writers, describes the basic objectives of journalism, that is, to inform, educate, criticize, and persuade. And in the book, he identified seven genres of news games. Now, not surprisingly, this book does not mention manual or analog games at all, except for a chapter discussing crosswords and other word games that appear in newspapers. That's really not surprising at all, because this academic area of cultural studies is almost completely devoted to computer and video games. But the fact remains that the practice of producing analog or manual news games in most of these genres predates video games and predates home computers by a very long time. And I think they stand as fine examples of citizen-based social criticism and analytic journalism. And today, I'm going to present some historical and current examples of these news games and their various uses under the objectives of journalism. So the products of this practice come in two strains. There's one that's more critical than analytical, tends to be simpler, and its equivalent would be something like an editorial cartoon that you'd find in a magazine or a newspaper. The other is more analytical and objective than it is critical, generally focuses on more complex topics of social or armed conflict, is aimed at a narrower audience, and therefore its journalistic analog would be one of those long special features that often run in the weekend editions. So let's call it the analytical strain, as opposed to the editorial strain. So I'm going to give some examples of both of these strains, the editorial first. And many of these examples that I'll cite are clearly examples of what Mary Flanagan, who's a game critic, describes in her book Critical Play as a purposeful remixing or reskinning of game designs of classical board games for the purpose of parody, satire, or to deliver a moral lesson that's somewhat altered from the original intent. This is the earliest example I've been able to find of an attempt to document and interpret a contemporary socio-political event in the form of a game. This was produced in 1791 in revolutionary France, and it's a large format colored print, and it uses the spiral track design, which is used in the traditional jeu d'oie or goose game, which is a traditional roll and move children's game in Europe, which used to be used for morality lessons, like Snakes and Ladders was in other countries. So players roll a die, and they progress through a chain of 63 illustrated segments on the board, starting with the storming of the Bastille, and ending with the signing of the French Constitution in September 1791. Another early example of this sort of game being used for satire is a game that was published in the Paris newspaper Le Figaro in 1889. It's about the career of General Ernest Boulanger, who was a politician at the time, who was threatening to lead a right-wing coup d'etat and become the dictator of France. So the designer in this case has used this familiar goose game format, which would be familiar to readers from their childhood as a vehicle of moral lessons, but instead it's subverted here, as the cellular structure of the game shows a narrative which is shot through with sarcastic comments on the stages of the general's military and political career. And here are two more examples on then contemporary issues. Here is one from 1909 on the suffragette movement called Pankasquith, and here's another from early 1945, which was war propaganda produced in the fascist Italian Social Republic, which followed the fall of Mussolini. This is from 1945. Now, in other countries, the structure and rules of simple roll and move games like Monopoly would often be used for these games because, again, the mechanics and convention would already be well known to readers from their childhoods. So therefore, the rules and learning the rules and mechanics of the game doesn't get in the way of the lesson of the game. Last week, The Guardian reported on a game from the Second World War that was found in an attic in Jersey. It's called Occupation, which is a simple roll and move game which was produced secretly by a printer on Jersey during the war, making very grim fun of life under the German occupiers. Now, even grimmer, in 1971, National Lampoon magazine, an American humor magazine, printed Welfare Monopoly, which is a playable parody in which one player is a slumlord and the rest of the players are renters on public assistance. There's seven different ways to end up in jail, and if you're unable to pay your rent, you may be killed by the property owner. So the winner's the last one alive. Another one is a well-meaning attempt to explore the issues of race and poverty, which is Blacks and Whites, which was published in 1970 in Psychology Today magazine, another American magazine. Again, it uses the general concepts of Monopoly and was conceived of as a painless homily for middle-class whites to experience the frustrations of Blacks in America. And I don't have illustrations, but The Economist magazine has in the past also published a couple of lighthearted games on financial crises and corruption. Here are some small press examples of this kind of critical game. A game called War on Terror was published in 2006. It begins by adapting the familiar Conquer the World mechanisms of Risk, which is again another game that would be familiar to a lot of people from their childhood, but it adds a terrorist player. And players begin the game by trying to build a proper empire, but in most games they go bankrupt and become terrorist players themselves as the entire world expires in chaos and violence. Now more recently, a game called Bycatch has appeared, which explores the quandaries of drone warfare. Players hold hands of cards, and they choose which cards of their rivals are eliminated based on information conveyed by very badly focused cell phone pictures they take of those cards from the previous turn. I think this is a very potent commentary on the collection and use of intelligence and its human costs. And finally, there are some simplistic and frankly rather juvenile card games like the Suicide Bomber card game, which I just present as an example of black humor. Now, the 1990s saw the mass arrival of desktop computers in homes and, of course, the advent of the internet. This also saw the beginning of the print-and-play game format, which was enabled by the development of cheap, easy-to-use software, the PDF file, and being able to use the internet to store and distribute these games quickly. A check of BoardGameGeek.com reveals hundreds of these free web-published games by individual people or small companies. Most of these games are idle amusements, but here's a sample of some games with satirical or critical political content. And most notorious of all, the legendary party game, card game, Cards Against Humanity has long been available as free print and play under a Creative Commons license. Now, Terrible Games, which is the company that published War on Terror that I've mentioned, has also placed a number of free print and play editorial games on their website. And I present here four examples on topics from managing public relations during the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster, to a subversion of Snakes and Ladders as a reflection on class origins and inequality, and arms sales, and finally one about the Ground Zero Mosque controversy in Manhattan. So those are examples of editorial news games. Now, I'd like to talk about the other strain of manual news game, the one that's analogous to the analytical data-heavy weekend special feature piece. So here is James Dunnigan. This is a man who needs obviously no introduction to many people in this room. In 1969, he founded Simulations Publications Incorporated while he was still an undergraduate student at Columbia University in New York. This was one of the first publishing companies devoted to hobby wargaming, and it would publish more than 300 wargames before it folded in 1982. About 100 of these designs were Dunnigan's. Dunnigan was also fascinated by the ability of board games to explore contemporary and hypothetical conflicts. And about a quarter of the company's total output was published in Strategy and Tactics, which is a bi-monthly magazine that was the first periodical devoted to wargaming that contained playable games. And the original company, as I said, is no more, but the magazine is still active and has just published its 313th issue. And one of Dunnigan's first designs, though, was an editorial game, which was a satire on campus unrest. This appeared in the Columbia Daily Spectator, Columbia University's student paper, in March 1969. It's interesting because the game board, which is a number of trails winding around the buildings of the Columbia campus, looks like a standard roll and move game. But actually, these trails are measures of the attitudes of different groups contending within the university's power structure. So conservative students, alumni, tenured faculty, and so on. and the game revolves around allocating player resources to change these. Now, each issue of Strategy and Tactics contained a playable game. These games were something that were very different for their time. They were sophisticated, they were thoroughly researched and modeled simulations for the most case, designed by people who were generally not professional analysts or historians, but enthusiastic amateurs. Besides the game, the magazine would also contain 5,000 to 10,000 words or more of analysis, that is, the history, course, and broader aspects of the conflict portrayed in the game. Normally, this would also be written by the game's designer. So the writer's research would be presented twice, once as a standard written feature in a magazine, and again where the research is quantified, joined with a set of game mechanics to make a game that readers could play and explore the topic for themselves. I think these are clear examples of amateur analytic journalism and the reversion of the platform genre of news games, which is described in Bobo's books, where a game is supported by extensive background material. This points up a crucial difference. Where the editorial games were generally short, simple, and frankly quite biased, an analytical war game, news game, is generally longer, more complex, and is concerned with historical simulation or validation. I'll be going into this question at other times during this conference, including a panel specifically on validation tomorrow, so I'll just mention its salience here. Now, I mentioned before that Dunnigan was also very interested in the ability of board games to explore contemporary conflicts. Now, one of the earliest examples of this that appeared in his magazine was Year of the Rat, a game on the Easter Offensive in Vietnam in 1972. This was published less than 6 months after the actual event. And in 1972 terms, I think that's still within one news cycle. An even better example was the following year when SPI staff were working on Sinai, which was a game on past Arab-Israeli wars. The design included a hypothetical 1970s scenario, and just as they were playtesting this scenario, the actual 1973 Yom Kippur War started. And the story is told that most days while they were playtesting this game, a military attaché from the Israeli consulate in New York, who was a war gamer himself, would stop by most days to see how testing was going and what kind of results were being generated from the game. And finally, a third is the game Arabian Nightmare Kuwait War. This game on the first Gulf War was probably the first manual war game to be designed, tested, and developed mainly over the internet. Within days of the Iraqi invasion in August of 1990, James Dunnigan and his co-designer Austin Bay began to communicate over the Genie online service, if any of you remember Genie, with developers, playtesters, and graphic artists to create a game that reached subscribers in January 1991, just before the real Operation Desert Storm got underway. Now, over the years, many games on hypothetical topics appeared in this magazine and related magazines. The ones published before 1990 deal with large-scale regional wars or a World War III that never happened. And this speculative practice continues to this day. Now, the more recent ones also reflect many of our current fears and concerns, from piracy off the Horn of Africa to a future collapse of China or a war of all against all in the Middle East. Now, I mentioned earlier how personal computers and the internet had made rapid design and distribution of manual editorial news games possible. But the same factors apply to production of manual analytical games on current and hypothetical topics. I'll give a couple examples, two from my own work. At the end of 1999, there were 3 days of popular demonstrations against the World Trade Organization conference in Seattle. Within 2 weeks of the event, I designed Battle of Seattle. This design reflected some of my thoughts at the time about violent civic confrontations and perceptions of how one side or the other could win the battle, not physically, but through image leverage and information dominance. It was a mostly serious game on an important episode of public protest. But I also gave it a somewhat satirical quality, as you can see, if you can see them clearly, from the playful images I put on the counters and some random events in the game like paperwork, where you have to remove a police unit and it spends the rest of the game filling out forms. I've made the game files available for free on my personal website and on BoardGameGeek for years, but they were also very promptly copylefted and have appeared on some anarchist and radical websites. I don't mind, as long as they name check. In November 2012, in response to the Gaza missile crisis, a designer named Paul Rohrbaugh produced a solitaire game called A Rain of Missiles, in which the player attempts to defend Israeli territory from randomized rocket and missile launches from Gaza. What's interesting about this design is not only the speed with which it was produced, again, within 2 weeks, but also that it was featured in an issue of Foreign Policy magazine. The files to the map, the counters, and the rules were linked to the online version of an article on the missile crisis, written by Michael Peck, who is a journalist who is also a war gamer. Readers were invited to download the files, print them out, make comments and suggestions, and many of them did. And more recently, you will recall that in March 2014, the people of the Crimea held a referendum to decide whether they should stay in Ukraine. This was a drastic escalation of the brinkmanship and potential violence in the region. So I did what anyone with an interest in current events and a few hours on his hands would do. Within 48 hours, I had designed a manual game, a political, military information game on the crisis, which I called Ukrainian Crisis. Obviously, I spent my time thinking about the design, not on a catchy title. I posted the game files to my webpage for free download on the evening of March 16th, which was the day of the referendum itself. And it's been available as a free print and play from my website ever since, and the game files have been downloaded over 1,000 times. Now, I haven't said much at all about the analog-digital divide in games here, and I won't, except to make the obvious point that as the programming of computer war games gained in sophistication, the rules themselves faded from sight. This is fine for most players, but it also removed access to an understanding of the rules, which is the critical site for analysis of a game's assumptions and its mechanics that it uses to model reality. James Dunnigan called this the black boxing syndrome. Later, this term spread further as shorthand to denote how rules, roles, and expectations are embedded into physical and social structures to the extent that they're no longer even visible to the people in them. Dunnigan also said about these games, if you can play them, you can design them. He meant that by playing a manual game brings its players into intimate contact with the game's design and its mechanics expressed through its rules. The player can't help but be exposed to its structure, logic, and intent in a very different way from the code that underlies a digital game. More importantly, this gives power to the person who likes to play games and has something to say or needs to understand something in a different way, in that the game can be easily changed, altered, subverted, or even inverted to suit their own purposes and inclinations. And it's this critical and questioning attitude that I've always liked best about James Dunnigan personally, and it applies to both the editorial and analytical strain of news games. I think that taking this to heart gives an obvious added dimension to the term citizen journalism. Citizens owe it to themselves and to their society to be informed and warily critical of the society that they live in. They can be their own observers and interpreters of events through logging or blogging and the use of social media. They can also go deeper and explore the processes and become designers that give rise and explore the rise to these events or to speculate on their direction. And they can prompt others to do the same, not just through words on a screen, but through games that are made and played on paper.